In the world of medical influencers, the only thing crazier than the menopause world is the skin world. Let's face it, there's a lot of people that are making millions selling lotions and potions that promise to make your 50-year-old skin look like it did when you were 20 and Jennifer Aniston hair. And it's easy to be convincing when you can generate an AI image of a 70-year-old who looks like a teenager all because of their miracle product. Enter Dr. Ellen Gendler. You know her, the New York dermatologist who's the voice of reason, wildly entertaining, but most important is the voice of science in a sea of skinfluencers. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, a gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause midlife and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. Aside from Instagram fame, where Dr. Gendler now has over 200,000 followers, okay, I admit it, so jealous. Dr. Gendler is a clinical associate professor of dermatology at NYU Langone Medical Center, a fellow of the American Academy of Dermatology, and a former trustee of the Dermatology Foundation. She's the author of numerous scientific publications. In other words, the real deal. She's also a good friend and always makes me laugh. So, hi, Helen.
Hi, thanks for having me this afternoon.
Do you remember the last time I had you on and I kind of blindsided you and I asked you if someone was sentenced to 10 years in prison and could bring only three skin products, what would they be? Well, I'm not going to ask you.
You mean Jeffrey Epstein? Oh, go ahead.
Well, yeah, exactly. That would be an interesting thought. But okay, I'm not going to ask you that. But for anyone who's curious or has recently been sentenced to prison, and there may be a whole line that's about to happen, the link to that episode is in the program notes. But before we get to the gazillions, and I mean gazillions of questions that came in, I'm going to start with this. Just throw out a few of the most outrageous things that you've heard lately on social media that either made you laugh or made your blood boil or more likely both.
Oh, gosh, there's just so many. It's hard to think. One thing is that rubbing any kind of metal device on your face will help with wrinkles or help treat your acne. Another thing is that eating certain foods can make your hair grow back. Another thing is that using different kinds of devices can lift your skin better than a facelift. I mean, the list is just absolutely endless. Or that drinking a drink with a certain kind of what they call sun powder can cause you to prevent skin cancer incredibly. I mean, the stuff is, it just never stops.
I mean, that's the problem with going down that rabbit hole is I know you have a busy practice and you stop sometimes or in between patients and just throw out a comment, and it's got to be hard to just not keep on going because that's the problem with social media. You see one thing and then all of a sudden 50 other things pop up that are even worse.
It's true. And I try to answer as many messages as I can, but it's completely overwhelming, obviously, to practice full time and then do this. It's late at night and people ask very specific questions, which is not really appropriate in an Instagram format. They give me their whole case history and say, what should I do?
Yeah. It's amazing. So, and these are not anonymous. I mean, people can tell who they are. And people ask me their crotch questions all the time.
So I'm not being rude when I don't answer specifically, but you know, it's hard to give specific medical advice when I've never even seen what you look like. But I'll do the best I can to give a general overview that helps direct you where you need to be.
Yeah, you're much nicer than I am. I just honestly, I just get overwhelmed and don't answer that stuff. All right, you know what? Let's get going because we have so many questions. So we're going to do a rapid fire Q&A. And, you know, we're both fast talkers. We're going to keep it going. We're going to make it through as many as possible until we run out of time. And just as a reminder, as you were just saying, we're here to educate and maybe entertain, but not to give individual medical advice because you need to get that from someone who actually looks at your skin. You have to take your clothes off. So we're just here to give information. And here's the plan. We're going to start with some general questions about skincare, and then I'm going to kind of start at the top with scalp and hair and then just keep on moving down. We probably won't make it to the vulva and the vagina, but I'm okay if we don't because that stuff I feel pretty comfortable.
You can handle. Right.
Exactly. Another day. All right. Here we go. A lot of loose skin out there. A lot of loose skin. This was a recurrent theme. And the thing that came up again and again is something I'm not familiar with, and that's microneedling. So what is it and what's the deal with microneedling?
Microneedling is a procedure where a little device is used that is rubbed. We do it on the face. We don't really do it on the rest of the body. It's a tiny little, looks like a pen with these little needles, and they are run over your face, creating tiny injuries that produce small amounts of blood at each needle point. I've been actually doing this probably 20 years. And what's the premise behind microneedling? Well, it's that the skin is tricked because it's constantly being injured. And because it's injured, it's always in healing mode. So the thinking behind it is that because of that, the skin is always going to be regenerating collagen. And people believe that by doing that, you will keep your skin as good as it can be. Now, what does it not do? Listen, it's not going to prevent you from getting lines on your face, not going to prevent you from getting brown spots, but is it a stimulus to produce collagen? I suppose. I mean, the results are not miraculous.
Wait, is this to prevent or is this to repair?
Well, you can say both. For me, it's really about preventing. But if you use a deep enough needle setting and go over the skin enough times with enough passes, you can create a serious injury, not quite like a dermabrasion, but a pretty deep injury. And we use it sometimes on acne scars. In my opinion, not even close to as effective as an ablative CO2 laser. But it's less expensive and it's less time consuming, and some people prefer it. To me, it's not a miracle, but it's a nice adjunct. I tend to use this in younger people more than older people, because at least I'll be doing something to help protect them when they get older. But over the last few years, back in the day, maybe in the late 1990s or early 2000s, I would do microneedling alone. That's what the guys from South Africa, a plastic surgeon named Des Fernandez, invented this. I had the very first device. It was like a barbaric little piece of equipment. And it did create quite a bit of downtime. They've been streamlined since then. They're electric, and they you know, you roll them over the face. So I have the benefit of having done this for a long time and seeing what people's skin looks like. And I think it's really very helpful. But I have my patients doing all sorts of other things as far as creams and sunscreens and such as well. But in the last few years, microneedling has had developed a partner, radio frequency microneedling. And this is a whole other kettle of fish that's filled with problems. Okay, so microneedling itself shouldn't have too many problems. There obviously can be problems, but there nothing like radio frequency microneedling, which is when heat is delivered down the needles deep into the skin. And the goal is to tighten the skin. I can't say I've ever seen it do that, but I have seen lots of problems where the fat is dissolved, people get scarring. It's not something I recommend. And I make a lot of enemies because of this.
And that was another thing that came up a lot. I mean, what's so interesting to me is here's something that clearly shouldn't be done. And yet a lot of questions came in about it, which means a lot of people are being told to do it. You mentioned laser. So the ultrasound and laser were the two other things that came up. Before we get to laser, is there any place for ultrasound in terms of tightening skin?
You know, ultrasound is not a bad thing, but there's Ulthera and there's Softwave. And neither of them is a home run. I would say maybe between a single and a double. And there's no evidence that the results are very long lasting. It can be helpful, but I don't want anyone to think this substitutes for a facelift. It does not. So if somebody has an event and they want to do some gentle tightening with the proviso that they realize that it's not going to be a real miracle, you know, I will do it. I do Softwave because it's less painful and less invasive than Ulthera. But, you know, people who do Ulthera think it helps. My statement is usually it works great on people who don't really need it. So if you're 40 years old and you don't really need it, those people think it's wonderful. When you're 65 years old, usually you don't.
All right. So, and again, short of surgery, if someone wants to do something without surgery to tighten their skin, to get rid of that loose skin, then we're really talking about laser.
No, lasers do not get rid of loose skin on the neck. It's usually the neck that people are complaining about, right? That's the neck and the jawline that people are complaining about. And that's when we use these other modalities where we use ultrasound, or some people use radio frequency microneedling. I will not do that, but using ultrasound is mildly helpful. It's not in any way something that you're going to jump up and down and say, this is the greatest thing I ever did. Lasers on the neck are not used to tighten. They're not.
How about laser? What's that going to do for you? Anything
for your neck?
Just skin, wherever it is. Just skin, any, you know, any place on the butt. We're just talking general skin stuff.
Well, that's like saying, well, what's laser going to do? That's like saying, well, if I want to drive, should I get that car? There's 1,000 types of lasers. Yeah. There's lasers that attack blood vessels. There's lasers that attack pigment. There's lasers that attack skin wrinkling. There's everything. So there's not one size fits all.
I just kind of lose skin and tightening skin right now.
There's no laser that really tightens skin. No matter what anyone tells you, it's BS. What an ablative CO2 laser can do is make the surface of your skin look much nicer, much more even, maybe eliminate some fine lines, help with acne scars, maybe help prevent against skin cancer and remove some precancerous keratoses and just make your skin smoother. But thinking that your skin is going to be tighter is a complete misconception.
And this is a misconception. Again, people wrote in saying, I've been told to get laser to tighten up my skin. So there you go.
Complete nonsense. So usually med spas say that.
Well, of course. All right. Still along the lines of loose skin. Now I want to switch to belly and buttocks, a skin that's gotten stretched out maybe after a twin pregnancy, or when this, you know, common weight loss that a lot of people are having in the area of GLP-1s. And the people that wrote in about this, and there were a number of them, made the point of, you know, they were exercising, weightlifting, doing everything they were supposed to do, and they still had this loose skin. So
right.
Short of surgery, is there anything that anyone can do for the belly stuff and the butt stuff?
Not really. Short of surgery, it's minimal improvement. Minimal. I mean that seriously. Yeah. Doing any of these things, some people think temporarily it looks a little better, but it's never a sustained response. It really isn't. And it's just a waste of money. When you lose significant amounts of weight after a GLP-1 or after anything, frankly, or if you've had twins, and especially when you're a very thin, small person, I've seen women whose bellies literally hang over. They hang over. There's nothing but surgery that really is going to fix that. That's the God's honest truth.
No one wrote in about Ozempic vulva. I don't know. I get about that one.
They didn't? I thought I saw some on your list, but let's not talk about that because they will make an Ozempic anything. They'll make it. It's not even about Ozempic. It's about weight loss. And the thing is that most people that we know nowadays, everyone is losing weight on Ozempic or Wegovy or Mounjaro or whatever. But you know, back in the day, there were people who actually went on a diet and lost 100 pounds and they had the same problems that we see now.
You know, and after bypass and all that, I already know the answer to this question, but let's just give a quick yes or no. So what do you think of the new cream specifically marketed for people on GLP-1s?
That's one of the things that actually makes me wretch. It makes me wretch. It's such an abuse. It's so awful. So now you have what I think about it.
Okay.
Anytime I see a doctor that says that, I immediately write a comment. And I make like a big smiley face or a vomit face or something like that to express my...
Do you have an opinion about this?
It's just so... Don't listen to any of that. It's such BS.
All right. We're moving away from loose skin and turning to crepey skin.
That's loose skin. Crepey skin is kind of loose skin.
Okay. But it is different. It's all about the arms, you know? And everybody asks, is there any either over-the-counter or prescription product that's actually going to help with crepey skin? And then a lot of peptides. There's that too.
Okay. So I think the answer is probably no. Having said that, there are things that I've tried, and I don't know, maybe I'm just making myself believe that some of these creams are helping or keeping it at bay, but crepey skin is just a loss of collagen. So it looks crepey on the arms because you don't have thick fat layers there, like on the butt. When you lose a lot of weight and your butt flattens, you know, it kind of hangs down. Your arms don't really hang down except on the upper part of your arm. So keeping the skin surface smooth, I would say retinoids are helpful, helpful to help prevent the surface. But the intrinsic aging, that fine crepiness, you really cannot fix that. Using creams and supporting the barrier can help it look better, but there's no material change in the crepiness. That is the truth. That doesn't mean you shouldn't use moisturizers and try to make them look better, because certainly dry, crepey skin is awful.
Yeah, so it's really about the moisturizers just to plump it up a little bit.
But that's really what it is. You cannot put collagen under the skin, a crepey arm. You just can't. Yeah. It's not going to happen. It's prevention that you want to deal with. The young women, the 20-year-olds, should be staying. Yeah, sunscreen, because that's the main cause. Sunscreen and avoiding smoking, those would be the two biggest factors in trying to keep your skin as good as it's genetically programmed to be.
And while we're on the topic of sunscreen, because I know this is something that you talk about a lot, real quick, the difference between American sunscreens and European sunscreens.
Well, that's a really good question, and it's the one that plagues me every day of my life. Just very briefly, in the United States, we have a limited number of sun filters that are approved, because sunscreens are considered drugs in the United States. And for so many years, we've had very limited numbers of sunscreens that actually shield against ultraviolet A. Those are the deeper penetrating ultraviolet rays that are a big contributor to skin cancer and also to all the aging aspects of the skin, brown spots, keratoses, etc. We have one chemical filter that's called avobenzone. That's the only thing we've had for the last 20 years. Nothing has changed. In Europe, they have seven. They have so many filters that are getting better for UVA. And because they're not considered drugs there, it's a different approval process. However, after many years of fighting and trying to lobby Congress and just constant attempts to get these things approved, it looks as if in June we probably will get one more UVA filter, Tynosorb S, or Bimotrizinol, which is a really nice UVA filter. And it works so much better than avobenzone, which is the only one we have here. Any of you who are listening, you may think that you're using a great sunscreen and it says broad spectrum, and yet you put it on and you continue to get tan. That's because the ultraviolet A rays, which are the tanning rays, are not being blocked sufficiently, okay? When you add a second filter, and Tynosorb S or Bimotrizinol is a better UVA protector than avobenzone, you're going to get notably better protection, and we're very excited about it. It's not a done deal yet, but we're really optimistic. There are still other ingredients they have in Europe aside from that are much better that we're not going to have yet. But at least companies in the U.S. will have other things to formulate with, which is a huge sign of progress.
And in the meantime, just wear a big hat.
A hat's a hat. It doesn't, And also, by the way, people think that mineral sunscreens are better than chemical. That's complete hogwash. Zinc oxide, titanium dioxide is not a very good sunscreen, so nix that. Zinc oxide, if it's non-nano, think about the old-fashioned lifeguards who had those big white noses when you smeared it on. It's like diaper rash ointment. That's pretty good protection, but nobody can use that. So they've micronized the zinc oxide, made these tiny little nanoparticles to make them more cosmetically elegant. And in doing so, they also diminish the protection that they afford. So people think that mineral sunscreens are better, healthier, more natural. Zinc oxide is not natural. The only thing I can say about those products is that they tend to have fewer preservatives and fewer ingredients in the product as a whole. So that if you're someone with very sensitive skin, there are fewer things for you to react to. But as far as shielding you from ultraviolet A and B, a good chemical sunscreen, preferably from Europe or Asia or South America or Canada, is a better option than mineral.
Someone wrote in specifically about using 20% zinc oxide ointment in a petroleum mineral face.
Nice. Try that.
Underneath her normal, let it dry, and then put on her SPF 45 product. Is that a good strategy?
I could not even imagine. I mean, well, but let me say that. Let me go back. She said a 20%, that she means a 20% zinc oxide formulation.
I'm just reading from her note.
Yeah. I was thinking 40% zinc oxide, which is basically Desitin ointment. And I couldn't imagine using it. You know, is it, what's the question? Is it better than a good European? Absolutely not. The American sunscreens, SPF 45, 50, 100, whatever they call themselves, they're not allowed to say more than 50, but they do. The best UVA ingredient is inferior. It's avobenzone in the U.S. sunscreens. It's degraded by light. It's unstable. So it has to be partnered with other things like octinoxate in order to even be effective for more than a few minutes. So you can put that on top of, you know, mediocre on top of mediocre does not give better. It gives mediocre.
The best strategy is to go to Europe and pick up something, which is what I did. Remember when I was calling Mackie and I texted you a picture of us standing in the pharmacy in front of all the sunscreens and said, which one should we buy?
But you know what? Unfortunately, until pretty recently, you could actually get them on different websites and order them and it very inexpensively. But since the tariff situation, it's a huge problem because even ordering a few tubes of sunscreen from Europe, you could end up with a $200, $400 duty on that box. So it's really a problem now. I agree. It's a problem. Big problem.
Okay, another last one on the face, quick on this one. A woman who didn't mention wrinkles or looseness or anything else. She just said, look, my skin just looks dull and old. And my dermatologist is trying to talk me into a CO2 laser. Is they just trying to make money or is that actually going to do something to me?
Well, again, I can't comment on what your face looks like, so I don't know how to tell you if you're just trying to make money. But the thing about doing laser for a situation like this, I will never do laser on someone unless they are using certain things on their face in a skincare regimen. Never. Because you will not get a sustained response unless you're using certain things. You've got to be using antioxidants. You've got to be using retinoids. You've got, in my opinion, you should be using DNA repair. And then I have you do that for a month or sometimes more, and also a brightener. So if someone has a lot of pigment and you don't use something that helps diminish pigment and keep pigment away, you can do a CO2 laser, an ablative CO2 or non-ablative, and some pigment lightens. And then 2 weeks later, the stuff's back. You have to maintain. So I would say your doctor needs to instruct you on what a pre-laser regimen is. I'm actually giving a big talk at the laser meetings in May about just this, because so often physicians, even dermatologists, don't discuss what to do before and what to do after. It's just about the procedure. And med spas, forget about it.
You threw a brightener. Is a brightener a product that you put on your face?
It's a description of a type of product. So things that lighten your pigment, take your pigment down, would be things like hydroquinone, arbutin, and even antioxidants like vitamin C, L-ascorbic acid. That does tend to brighten the skin because it does help take pigmentation down.
Okay, well, I'm going to jump ahead then, since you're talking about pigmentation and brown spots, because that's pigmentation, right?
It is.
Brown spots, particularly on the face. So all the questions are basically along the lines of, A, is there anything you can put on it that's going to help? Can a dermatologist remove them? You know, what does someone do if they really want to get those brown spots off their face?
Okay, all brown spots are not created equal. There are brown spots that are raised that we call seborrheic keratoses, and they appear in people as they get older. Those cannot be lasered off. They have to be removed, either frozen, which I hate doing, gently scraped. They cannot be treated with laser successfully. There are flat versions that people call liver spots or age spots. Those are flat seborrheic keratoses, and they can be treated sometimes with a bleaching cream, a brightening cream like hydroquinone or arbutin. Those can be lightened somewhat, or they can be lasered if they're not elevated. And that doesn't mean they won't come back. But if you maintain, then you have a good chance of keeping many of them at bay. So when people ask me, what should I do about my brown spots? You have to first figure out what they mean. Which type of brown spot? Or are they talking about melasma, which is a brown spot that appears over an area of your face, often over the lip or on the cheeks? That's a different type of pigmentation. But that's another thing that to discuss. You know, that can happen in young people, pregnant people, people on the birth control pill. That's a typical period of life to see it.
Right, which is more of an, like you said, more of an area than a spot. Okay, moving on to itchy skin. Itchy skin, a lot of questions about that. Back itching, general body itching, itching along the brow line. People who said I took hormone therapy because I thought that would help my itchy, crawly skin, and it's not. People that are using body oil, Eucerin anti-itch lotion, nothing's working.
Imagine there are 10,000 products that people use that they think will help their itch. Let's talk about why people itch. The biggest reason, it sounds, in the people who are writing in, is that their skin is just very dry. Okay. So if you are dry, you will itch. So getting rid of the dry skin means moisturizing and using a really good, nice, thick moisturizer. Oil is not a good moisturizer. Vaseline or Aquaphor petrolatum works really nicely, but you can't leave your house. You look a greasy mess. So you've got to find moisturizers that do the job without leaving you disgusting. And it can be a chore, and there are so many on the market. I like using moisturizers for really dry skin that have lactic acid. If they have glycolic acid, it's less effective. Sometimes even urea, and it depends on what part of the body. So there's many over-the-counter, inexpensive moisturizers that have this, and there are some you can get online. You know, I don't like to say brand names, but if people write to me, I sometimes will tell them in private. I don't like to talk on podcasts with particular names.
What, 20,000 people that hear this?
Okay.
Our little private group.
But the question about the itching on the brow line, that's an interesting one, because there's a condition that's called lichen amyloid. It's really common, and it's an itchy patch on the back. It does tend to happen more often in women, but I see it in men too. And no one knows why it starts, but it seems to start around the back of the bra, and you get an itch and you start to scratch, and then itch begets itch, begets itch, and it keeps going, and you keep scratching, and you ultimately end up with a darker brown, a darker pigmented patch exactly where you itch. And sometimes that itch could drive you mad, where you have to lean against a doorknob and rub up. It's so infuriating. And there are different ways that we treat that. We sometimes try topical steroids in case there's some inflammation. We try topical anesthetics. There are oral meds that we use for people who are really suffering badly. There are some topical things that we use to treat herpes zoster or shingles. And sometimes we even use those on this condition. So the bra line itch can be a really annoying problem.
Not to mention, it's hard to get to.
People find ways. I mean, you know, the old fashioned back scratcher.
I have one of those for my itchy back. Speaking of which, as someone with an itchy back whose dermatologist said, yeah, put moisturizer on, but wasn't specific, and I guess I'll have to ask you later. But
okay.
You know, short of having someone who happens to live with you to put it on, what's the trick to get
Now I'm going to say that there's a brand, and I don't even know if they make this anymore, but if you go on Amazon, the whole bunch of generic versions will come up. And it used to be called L'applique, like L apostrophe, applique in French, the applicator. It's the coolest thing. It looks like a back scratcher, but instead of having those hands that scratch, it has a little pad where a sponge sticks to it. And it's designed, it was part of an occupational therapy development, I guess, where people who live alone have to apply things to their back. So you get this, the sponges are replaceable, you put your cream on it, you put it on your back, and it works like a charm. Just go on Amazon. And
I'm already going
back
there.
Applicator or something like that.
Anyone wants to buy me a present? Okay. And more than one person did ask about Eucerin anti-itch body lotion.
It's no better than anything else. Sometimes some lotions contain menthol and phenol, which are tingling. Sarna is one of those. And, you know, those can be helpful for a few minutes, but they don't offer any sustained benefit, really.
Well, it's kind of like oil. Oil feels good for a few minutes.
Right. But it's not a real good moisturizer. It's really not. And you'll see it dries down and not at all.
A little shinier and brighter, which is, you know, always nice.
Yeah, but you also are greasy. So unless it's dry oil, and a dry oil goes into your skin so quickly that it really has very, very little effect. People try coconut oil, all kinds of things, and it really doesn't work.
And they put
it
on their vulvas. Don't get me started.
Right. And they drink it too. And they put it in their coffee.
They put it in their vaginas. I mean, there's no end.
Everywhere. Okay.
This is something I actually never thought about, and I was curious myself. A woman wrote in whose earlobes have gotten really thin, and she can't wear earrings, and she wants to know if there's a filler or something she can do to plump them up so she can wear her pierced disease.
Yeah, there actually is, believe it or not. And yes, a lot of people develop thinning of their earlobes like they develop thinning anywhere else on their body.
Except the hips and the thighs.
Oh, you, right.
Your basal tissue gets thin. Your labia get thin. Your lips get thin. You know, why can't
everything? Why can't it just move up? But ears are a real issue. And it's a great place to put the tiniest bit of filler. And it can really change the way your earrings sit. It's amazing. So what I'll sometimes do when I'm finishing doing someone's face, I leave a tiny bit in my syringe. And then I just throw it in around the earring hole. And I swear to God, this is true. I did it to myself, to my earlobes. And then maybe a week or two later, I was shopping in a jewelry store looking for earrings, and the shop owner said to me, "Oh my God, you have the earlobes of a 20-year-old. And I couldn't even believe it. So if you make them look plumper, they look better, and they definitely stand up better to earrings. Don't sleep in earrings. Never sleep in earrings. That'll also help pull your earlobes down.
Well, not to mention that it would be really uncomfortable to poke you in the
people. Now people sleep in them all the time, always.
I guess so.
They do.
All right, so let's move on to hair. I might move back to some of this other stuff, but I do want to keep down here, and we're still up on the face and the hair. So Jennifer Aniston, with the gorgeous hair, is selling her own shampoo for $32. Will my hair look like hair if I use it?
Oh, for sure. After one use, you will look exactly like her.
Blonde and all, yeah.
So what's the deal with shampooing and hair loss? And this is a whole other thing on the internet. Thank you for, you said what things make you crazy. Here's another one. So hairdressers, I'm not exactly sure why they tell their clients not to wash their hair. I don't know why. I can't answer that. But they tell them that. And it's horrible. It's really a terrible idea. So would you ever not wash your face? The scalp is oilier than the face. And people get dandruff and they think it's dry scalp. It's not dry scalp in 90% of people. It's oily scalp, irritation, inflammation, and the scalp starts to slough off. And that's what those flakes are. So people then use dandruff shampoo to help lift the scales off. That can be helpful. But really, for many people, just washing your hair more often is the key to this. Now, you see this every day on the internet as well, that the biggest cause of hair loss is inflammation on the scalp. That's nonsense, nonsense. Theoretically, if your scalp is very inflamed, could it impact on hair loss? I guess it could, but it's not the big cause, not at all. It's never good to have inflammation anywhere. So washing your hair every day or as close to every day as possible, especially if you're a young, sweaty, oily person, it's almost imperative, and it will help protect you from getting acne as well.
Okay, but wait. If you wash your hair every day, that also means drying your hair every day.
Yeah, who said that?
You're going to get to hair. Well, not everyone has beautiful hair that they just can let it air dry. If I wash my hair,
okay,
I put my blow dryer out, and I've read a million times in, bad places that over drying your hair also is going to cause your hair to break
That could be true, but there's products that you can use to not overdry your hair. So you can do something to protect that. There are heat protecting solutions that you can put on your hair. You can dry your hair at a not too hot setting. You use conditioners and you don't take a brush and rip your hair. So you can also just gently, you can do what we call a rough dry, just sort of get a lot of the water out just without pulling on your hair, and then just gently for a few minutes dry it. So there are ways of protecting your hair from heat damage. Now, many of us after menopause have colored our hair, and coloring the hair is definitely damaging to the hair. So already we're subject to breakage, not necessarily falling out. Hair dye doesn't make your hair fall out, but it does contribute to hair breakage. And so that means you've got to cut your hair regularly and get the longest parts of the hair, which are the dead ends, right? They've been living long, they've been out in the environment longer than the scalp hair, right? The further away you are from the scalp, the longer you've been around. So just trim them back. And that's what you need to do. Using peroxide type bleaches is very damaging to hair. It breaks the bonds in the hair and makes it weaker. But that is not hair loss, that's hair breakage. when we talk about hair loss, you're talking about hair coming, either coming out at the root, falling out, or just not growing. That's hair loss.
And someone, and you kind of already answered this, but just to be specific, someone said, is ketoconazole 1% shampoo going to help prevent hair from falling out since it's anti-inflammatory?
You know, so maybe, but no. If the only reason that you're losing hair is because your scalp is inflamed and dirty and flaky and irritated, then sure, it'll definitely help. But for most people that have actual conditions of hair loss, which we can talk about, no, it's not going to help. It really isn't. But if you have dandruff, it's a good thing to try because you diminish the population of the yeast that lives on the scalp, which is called malassezia, and you diminish that population and you will have much less inflammation on your scalp.
So to return to my original question, we don't need to buy Jennifer Aniston's $32 shampoo. You can buy.
No, I would say you do not need to. But if it smells nice and you have a lot of money and you like the way it smells and you feel good, I have no objection. I don't even know what's in that. I assume it's not ketoconazole because that's not a very sexy ingredient.
Who knows? You know, and a lot of stuff also, I mean, and there's a million kinds of hair loss. So I know we could go on about that forever. But, you know, most people, when they're looking at postmenopause hair loss, they're looking at androgenic alopecia with, you know, the white part and receding hairline.
That's true.
A couple of questions came in just that wasn't the issue. It was really just more thin hair. And I didn't know from the question if thin hair, meaning that the actual follicle is thinner or there's just less of it. But
right.
They're both issues, correct?
And that's they're both issues. So there's two parts. There's thin hair and thinning hairs, and they mean two different things. Thin hair is someone who has very fine hair. Each strand is very fine. And as we get older, for many people, the hair becomes finer so that you can have thin hair. Thinned hair is hair that is thinning, meaning you don't have as much of it on your head. And that's a common problem postmenopausally, as you know. And there are different things that can be done to help that. When you talk about thin hair strands, there are hair products that attempt to thicken them by adding some protein to the strand itself. And it can give your hair some more body and make it feel thicker, but it isn't actually permanently thickening the hair strand. Does that make that clear?
All right. Before we get to oral minoxidil, because that's a lot of questions and where you and I want to go, but I just want to, you know, I think we're all on the same page with this one, all these millions of over-the-counter treatments and supplements and stuff. And don't get me started on Nutrafol, because you know how I feel about Nutrafol. And
their special
formulation for menopause, by the way, please out there, read my article. I will put the link, and I did the deep dive. I read all of their so-called science. There's none. They've never tested.
There is no science.
They've never tested in postmenopause women. And when they say it's a special formulation, and I'm not making this up, the ingredients in the menopause formulation are the same as the ingredients in the premenopause formulation. They're just in a different order to confuse the consumer. It is all,
In the different order, it's also interesting because they don't have to list them in descending order unless it's above 1%. But there is nothing in Nutrafol or in Wellbell or in any of these hair supplements.
Yeah.
There's nothing in them that it works very well. The reason they call themselves hair supporters is because they contain saw palmetto, which has a minimal effect of inhibiting the formation of DHT, dihydrotestosterone. Minimal compared to any of the things that actually work. So is it better than nothing? It might be, but not much better. And most of these contain biotin too.
They had one study in postmenopause women, and it was literally like 5 strands.
10 people.
Cubic, inch more than in the people who were not using product. And it's, beyond expensive. We don't have to go there. The point is there is no reason, and the Nutrafol
none.
Have my face on a dartboard in their office and they keep
and mine.
You know, please, we talk.
Stop.
But I just look at what's published. That's it. You know, I just keep saying to them, no, I don't want to talk. Just send me your studies.
There is no study. There are no studies.
And they keep
Zero.
They're in progress. And in progress now, I think it's 3 years of in progress, which means they're doing the studies and it's not showing anything. So they're going to keep doing new studies.
They keep going.
That does. Yeah. Okay, we're not going to waste any more time on
Don't waste your money on those things. Do not. So
let's talk about oral minoxidil, which, you know, you start coming. There were a few questions about oral minoxidil that were pretty specific.
Okay. So until fairly recently, last few years, we would recommend topical minoxidil, Rogaine, and it came in as a men's version and a women's version. The women's version was very weak, barely didn't work, so we'd have women use men's version, but it's very hard to use topical Rogaine because you've got to get it onto your scalp twice a day, and you rub, you know, then your hair looks terrible, and so people almost always abandon it. If you're a man and you have short hair and you have a, you know, bald scalp, it's easy to do it, but for women like you and me, it's really impossible to distribute this into your head. So oral minoxidil, that's how topical minoxidil came about 30 years ago, because people who were taking minoxidil for their blood pressure were growing hair. And that's how the studies were begun. So the doses that we use, let me back up a second. Oral minoxidil is very effective for both men and women, and it's safe, and we can talk about it. But for some women, if they have polycystic ovarian syndrome, and you can be 20 years old or 40 years old and have this and show signs of that, there's another medication that we use, which is very helpful alone or in combination with oral minoxidil, and that's spironolactone. So for a young woman, that's something I almost always start first and see whether they have get a response. And spironolactone is actually a diuretic that has an effect on the hormone receptors. It doesn't change the levels of hormones, but it helps the receptors not respond in the same way. Okay. It also helps for acne, by the way, in people that have hormonally based acne. And we give them anywhere from 50 to 200 milligrams of spironolactone with the caveat that they may urinate a lot at the beginning, et cetera. So that's one thing. But oral minoxidil in low doses is extremely helpful for hair growth in men and women, and very safe for most people, right? So we talk about low-dose oral minoxidil, but the doses we use are not that different from what they used to use in hypertension. Maybe they used to use 5 milligrams. I don't remember even giving more than 5 or maybe 10, but we start with low dose now. In women, I start them at 1.25 milligrams a day, okay? And there have been many, many studies to show that this can help many people. The smallest dose of commercially available minoxidil pill is 2.5 milligrams, which means you have to split the pills in half. And that is how I start my female patients. And I tell them to do it for 4 months, 5 months, 6 months to see whether they see an effect. And if they're not, they don't notice decreased shedding, and we can talk about the mechanisms in a minute. If they don't have decreased shedding or improved growth, then I will up them to 2.5, okay? What are the side effects of low-dose oral? We call it low-dose oral minoxidil, LDOM. There are quite a few side effects. Most of them are just annoying. And the biggest side effect is excess hair growth on the face and on the arms and on the legs and everywhere. It's like peach fuzz, right? And if you're somebody with darker hair, your peach fuzz tends to be darker. And it's annoying. So you have to figure out, now you're growing the hair on your head, but you have to figure out ways to get rid of the hair on your face. You would think that many people would quit taking the oral minoxidil because of this. I've had one patient, I prescribe it all day long. I've had one patient in the last couple of years who stopped it for that reason. You know, everybody figures it out. They get a dermaplane and they bring an at-home dermaplane. They shave it off, you know, they dermaplane it off or they wax it off or whatever they do, but their hair on their head is so good that they don't care. And that's the truth. So The studies will show, say, 33% or 35% of people get excess hair on their face. In my practice, it's 90%. So it's just not, I don't think it's reported. It happens. It really happens. And at the lower doses, you'll have less of that hair growth. So, you know, we have to balance the hair on your head and with the hair on your face. You don't want to have a full beard. That's the most common side effect. There are some other side effects. Occasionally, you can get swelling of your ankles. And for women over the age of 50, 55, I usually combine oral minoxidil with spironolactone, not for the hormone effects, but for the anti-water retention effects. So that's something we do also.
You retain water. It's such a low dose. It just seems...
No, you can. You definitely can. Yeah, because it helps with vasodilation. You definitely can. So my first, you know, this was like a complicated paradigm, but if I warn my patients about all these things, the first thing I do if they come in and they have swelling in their ankles, before I add another medicine, I have them wear compression hose to the best of their ability, and that often helps. If that doesn't help, then I add spironolactone. But if that happens, so now here comes a very tricky little thing. With minoxidil in normal doses, having a pericardial effusion or fluid around the heart is not rare, okay? And it's not necessarily dangerous, but it happens. So some people believe that if you are getting swelling in your ankles, that it's possible that you're also getting some fluid around your heart. We don't do scans. We don't do ultrasounds. We don't do, you know, echoes or ultrasounds of the heart routinely unless someone has a problem, but it's something you need to be aware of. So if you get swelling around your ankles and you're on oral minoxidil, I really like to talk to the internist and try to make a plan to just be, to watch that, okay? So palpitations, some people get it. Some people get a little dizzy. These are very uncommon things and not bothersome, but you just need to know about them. And then the most annoying side effect, which happens, I would say about 10% of people, we call it the dread shed. There are some people who start oral minoxidil and they shed like crazy, like half their hair comes out and it's calls in the middle of the night. It doesn't happen to many people, but when it does, it's really disconcerting and the hair always grows back. But imagine you're taking a medicine to get your hair back and you lose it. It doesn't go over well. It really doesn't. I warn patients about it. And then I say, let's sit in the corner and say a little prayer and hope you're not one of those unlucky people. But it does happen sometimes. And the belief is that it's because the new anagen hairs are growing out and pushing the older hairs that are getting ready to be in the resting phase or falling phase. And it's just getting rid of them because that's what minoxidil does. It strengthens the anagen phase. It increases the rate of growth of your hair. And it, you know, increases blood flow to the scalp. So that's some of the reason we believe that it helps, but it definitely helps. This is not speculation. This is tried and true. And it's one of the ways that in dermatology, some of these niche drugs are developed, such as the lash serums, where people who had glaucoma and were using bimatoprost, anti-glaucoma drugs that had prostaglandin analogs, their eyelashes would grow like hair, you know, long. And that then they were developed into being lash serum. So the same thing is how we developed minoxidil. So for women, I start at a very low dose, 1.25. Somebody asked the question, can you do half of that? You can do whatever you want. I don't know, does it work? There's no answer. They haven't studied 0.25. That they haven't studied. Not that I know. But, you know, the studies have been done on 1.25, 2.5, and 5. The higher the dose, the more the hair growth. But sometimes you just can't navigate the side effects, you know?
And last thing on minoxidil, I mean, if you stop, your hair is going to get thin again. There a initial dose and then maybe a maintenance dose?
I think that there is. If you get a reasonable amount of hair and then you taper off and you take the minoxidil, say 3 times a week, I don't think you will have a significant shed because it stays in your system. That's something that I definitely do. Now, there are some other oral medications that are used. Finasteride, which is used in men, as you know, Propecia, 1 milligram. And we use finasteride sometimes in women as well, but it's different because the 1 milligram dose that we use in men is not effective in women to grow hair. So women need to be on 2.5 or 5 milligrams of finasteride. All right. And finasteride works in a totally different way than minoxidil, because what finasteride does, it inhibits the type 2 alpha reductase. Okay. So it inhibits the enzyme that converts testosterone to dihydrotestosterone. Okay. So that's how that works. And for hormonally based alopecia or thinning, it does work, but it doesn't work in women as well as minoxidil. What works even better than finasteride in women and in men is dutasteride, because this inhibits both type 1 and type 2 alpha reductase, okay? So it's a more effective solution to hair loss, a hormonally based hair loss. What's the problem? Finasteride stays in the blood for maybe 6 hours or 8 hours, something like that. Dutasteride stays it there for a long time. Okay, it really stays there for a long time. So you've got to be really careful with it. You cannot be pregnant on either of these. And I don't like giving either of these drugs to people who are premenopausal and still capable of getting pregnant. I just don't. And if you touch crushed pills of finasteride and you're pregnant, you will have a problem. You know, this, the secondary genitalia characteristics are developed in boys with this, and you will have a problem. So men who keep their Propecia hanging around, I don't allow my pregnant people to go anywhere near it. So my paradigm is, you are a young woman whose hair is thinning. I see if you have PCOS, start you on spironolactone. That's not sufficient. Then we go to spironolactone and minoxidil. You're older, premenopausal, but not, you know, teenage with acne. I start you on low dose minoxidil. If I do that for 6 months, 8 months, and you're not getting hair, then I will add finasteride or dutasteride, depending on how old you are. Is that a good paradigm for you? Is that clear?
Another point that you made, but just to emphasize this, you're not going to get instant results. And I don't know if it was Nutrafol or another one that said, you know, money back guarantee in a month. And I'm thinking, well, you know, I'm a gynecologist, and I know that the hair growth cycle is what, at least 3 months, 4 months until you.
Yes. But one of the problems with aging is that everything gets worse, right? So your anagen phase shortens. That anagen is the growing phase. And it's really interesting. I think some people wrote in and said, I don't know what to do. My hair doesn't grow. Well, when you say your hair doesn't grow, I don't really know what that means. But there are people that
hadn't had a haircut in 5 years or something.
Right. So that means that that person's anagen phase has shortened. And it's suggested that at some point in this person's life, they were able to grow long hair. But there are people that have a condition that's called short anagen syndrome, where they can't grow their hair more than a few inches. That's that you're genetically programmed to have an anagen phase that is a certain length. So have you ever seen people whose hair is down to their knees? Those people have very long anagen phases. I don't think I could ever grow my hair down to my knees. I've never tried, but mine might be shorter, yours might be longer. So you have a genetic program for this. Minoxidil, oral minoxidil, can prolong the anagen phase, so your hair can grow longer and be thicker, and you have more hair on your head, so it appears thicker.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. All right. We're in big trouble here, because we're 55 minutes into this, and we're still on the top of the head. So I'm gonna throw out a few, I hope, somewhat quickie. Let's move on
okay.
to the eyes, a little bit of the eyes. Talking about droopy eyelids, and we know that, of course, surgery is, you know, what is really going to work. But short of surgery, I'd never heard of this one. I'm sure you have. A prescription product called Upneek, which is pulls up the eyelid.
So let's talk about what droopy eyelids. What does that mean? Most people who say they have droopy eyelids means they have droopy eyebrows, not eyelids. So a droopy eyebrow means that your brows are low and you have some loose skin under the brows, and the skin hangs over your eyes. And people call that droopy eyes. It's not. It's droopy brows. Okay. Droopy eyes are where your eyelid itself is low. That's called ptosis, P-T-O-S-I-S. And your eyelid is low. Some people are born with relatively ptotic lids. We call those bedroom eyes. And if you're a person who has an eyelid that's big, where you have a lot of room for eyeshadow, right? You could put shadow and liner and whatever. You may have somewhat low set lids. That's what Upneek helps treat. And there are people who, as they get older, develop ptosis of one eyelid. It can just be a function of the muscle in the eyelid becoming weaker, because it's a very thin, fine muscle and happens very commonly. It can also happen after you've had a blepharoplasty, after you've had eyelid surgery, or if you have a traumatic injury to your eye. Upneek is a drop that you put in your eye, and it stimulates Mueller's muscle in the eyelid, which is the muscle that helps you open your eye. And it works for 8 hours, and your eye will open. It's really one of the more miraculous things to put this drop in somebody's eye in your office, wait 15 minutes, and suddenly their eye is open. The effect lasts about 8 hours. but we don't recommend using it more than once a day. And I don't have people use this as an everyday thing. If someone has ptosis of the lid and they don't want to have surgery to get the lid lifted, then I'll recommend that they do it when they have reasons to have their eye completely open. They go into a party, they have an important meeting. I don't tell people to use it every day, but it does work really well for people with ptosis of the lids, not dropping of the brows, okay?
All right, so moving on down to the lower eye, this question came in last minute. Someone who'd had surgery, had had a lower blepharoplasty, lower eye job, if you will, but they was left with a lot of loose skin. And the plastic surgeon said, no, can't do anything about that, except if I remove that skin, it's going to make your eye look really small. So your eye, and so is there any way to tighten up that skin?
Well, that's a problem. If you're somebody with a significant laxity, and that happens sometimes when people have had a lot of filler put under their eyes or in their cheeks, and then it blocks the lymphatics and they get this big puffiness, and then they get the filler dissolved and the skin just hangs crepey. It's really tough. So the only solution there would be to try doing some laser resurfacing to tighten it a little. But when you have a lower bleph, it's not recommended to do that many times, because you can end up scarring the lower lid margin and pulling the eyelid down, and it's bad. But I respect a surgeon who doesn't take too much skin off. That I do respect that, but it's a really tough problem. So for this person who wrote that in, I would say go to a skilled laser surgeon and do some ablative CO2 lasering of that area.
And that'll help. All right. So I have about, 200 more questions, and we've got about 2 minutes.
We may have to do another one.
I'm going to do just one more thing, because there were so many about this, and that's marionette lines. What are the fillers that are going to help marionette lines the best, if there is such a thing that's going to help?
Okay, let's talk about marionette lines. Marionette lines are the lines on the sides of your mouth that come down from your nose and they go down to your chin. And if you look at your baby pictures when you're smiling, you have them too. So it's not about which filler is best for marionette lines, because it's not about the filler. The fillers are fill, but one is not better than the other. The problem is that marionette lines are muscular lines. Lines that are formed because of muscle action. And you could put all the filler on the ranch into the marionette line, and 10 minutes later, the person smiles and the filler is not there. So marionette lines, you can soften, but you cannot get rid of them. And if you put Botox around there, you won't smile, you won't be able to eat, you won't be able to chew, and you won't have marionette lines. You know, that's your trade-off. So they're natural, and people with very expressive faces have deeper marionette lines. But look at your 4-year-old. Look at your grandchildren. They have them already.
What's someone supposed to do who wants to do something about their marionette lines?
They get a facelift, and then it tightens the skin around it, and then there's less pull on the skin from the muscle, because there's less skin to pull. The way our skin ages is the muscles are stronger than the skin. So when you're young, your skin is thick, it's strong, it's turgid, and it fights back against the muscles. As we get older and the skin thins, it can't fight against the muscles, and the muscles win. And so that's, you get lines etched into the face between the eyebrows. Between the eyebrows is the etched lines, or because the corrugator muscles pull your brows down. On your cheeks, you start with marionette lines, and then some people get those lines going further back on their cheek. Look at how you smile and watch what the muscles in your face do, and that will tell you what kind of lines you're going to get. But I can say with 100% certainty that the deepest marionette lines and the deepest cheek lines are in smokers and sun-damaged skin. That is 100% true. It really is. So those are two things you want to avoid if you don't want to have bad marionettes or cheek lines.
And if it's too late for you, tell your children.
Tell your children, right. After all, it's all about them.
Oh my God. There, you know, you and I tried to do a retreat to get women.
We did.
And it didn't work out. We're going to have to do this again, because there were so many questions, and we could go on forever. And again, we didn't even get below the belly button. So there's just no end. So But thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for taking this time, for talking almost as fast as me. I think I have finally found someone who's even more opinionated than I am. And
I hope it helped. I hope that we dispelled some myths here, and we'll just keep going. We'll keep going.
So thank you. I will put all your information and tell people if they're not, if they're like the one person in the world who's not following you on Instagram, then they'll put where they can follow you. And of course, if someone's in the New York area, I can't think of anyone.
Come visit.
I would say come visit. So thank you. Thank you. And we will do this again.
Okay. We'll talk soon. Thanks. Bye, everyone.
Okay. That was a lot. And there were a ton of questions that came in about applying local estrogen to the skin. And honestly, if we'd done those, we wouldn't have had time for anything else. So this is what I'm going to do. I have an episode from last year that was devoted to estrogen for the face. I'm going to update it because there is some new data. There are some new issues. I'm going to add in all of your questions. I'll run it by Dr. Gendler, but I know we're pretty much on the same page with the estrogen on the face stuff. And then I'm going to put it back out there in a few weeks. So I will get to those questions. And I apologize for not getting to all of them, but there was really just no way. The other thing is, if we didn't get to your question, take a listen to the last episode I did with Dr. Gendler. I'm going to put the link in the program notes, and we covered a lot of areas that we just simply didn't have time for today. And of course, follow her on Instagram, not that she needs any other followers.